Iran says the outcome of the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA hinges upon a political decision by the United States. Palestinians hold a funeral for a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank amid tensions in the Flashpoint neighborhood of the occupied Al-Quds. And Bahrain's top Shia cleric and the main opposition group, Al-Wafaq, condemned the appointment of a naval Israeli officer to be stationed in the country. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Iran's top security official says that the fate of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA has come down to a political decision by Washington, obviating the need for speculations. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said that the negotiations have reached a stage that does not require guesswork and the result can be definitively declared. He said that the U.S. must decide whether it will embrace or refuse to accept the requirements for a reliable and durable agreement based on principles agreed to in the JCPOA. But the comments came as Iran and the remaining parties to the accord are engaged in diplomatic efforts in Vienna to restore the deal that was battered by the U.S. unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman also says that the country is awaiting a political decision by the Western side.
Currently going on in Vienna are discussions about very important, sensitive, outstanding issues. This is no secret to anyone. What remains is to reach a point where political decisions should be made. Tehran has already made its political decisions years ago and remained inside the JCPOA. Iran is now waiting to receive the response to its initiatives from the Western side in particular.
The spokesman said that currently there is no deadlock in the talks and negotiations will inevitably slow down as more serious issues are discussed and tougher decisions are needed. The spokesman has stressed that there is an inverse correlation between the will and resolve of the Western side and the time required to reach an agreement. Said Khatibzadeh says that all anti-Iran sanctions at odds with the JCPOA and Resolution 2231, which enshrines the deal, must be removed regardless of the label under which they've been imposed. Hamal Ezzghi is following the developments regarding the talks between Iran and the signatories to the JCPOA in Vienna. She explains how even some of the U.S. allies are becoming agitated at its failure to come to a decision.
Some sources have been saying or claiming that the Russians and the Chinese and even the Europeans are quite frustrated with the fact that the American team is not giving a firm response to these proposals or coming up with the decision that it needs to come up with. And this is seen as a sign of differences within the U.S. negotiating team itself, or also, of course, the pressure that the Biden administration faces from Republicans, from allies like Israel, etc. So these are all, of course, playing into the issue. What the Iranian sources say is that they are not here, as some Western media sources may claim, to prolong the negotiations, to drag things. They believe that an agreement is within sight. The Western side has said that they believe and a conclusion to these talks is also possible and within sight if the necessary decisions are made. The sticking points, of course, we know specifically on the scope of sanctions and the issue of verification and guarantees.
A fire is reportedly broken out at a support base of the Iranian armed forces in the western province of Kermanshah. Reports said the fire that's now contained was limited to a stock room for engine oil and other inflammable material. No one was hurt in the incident at the base belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. An investigation is going on to determine the damage and the cause of the fire. The Palestinian Prisoner Association has announced a comprehensive strike in all Israeli jails amid new controversy over the Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. The call for a strike comes amid confrontation between regime forces and Palestinian protesters over the planned eviction of resident families and demolition of their homes in Sheikh Jarrah. Protests erupted on Sunday after a far-right Israeli lawmaker visited the area and opened a parliamentary office there. 30 Palestinians got injured after Israeli forces and extremist settlers attacked the protest. Regime forces remain heavily deployed to the neighborhood. Meantime, hundreds held a funeral procession in the northern West Bank for a Palestinian teenager who was shot dead by Israeli forces. The 17-year-old was shot in the head during a protest against the Israeli destruction of a Palestinian house. Protesters initially managed to prevent the demolition in the town of Jenin, but regime forces returned to the area and razed the structure overnight. Israel frequently destroys the homes of Palestinians allegedly involved in attacks on settlers, and that's beside separate destructions under the regime's settlement expansion policies. A short while ago, we're joined by correspondent Ramallah. Mona Kandil provided some details regarding the Israeli violence in Jenin and Al-Quds.
What happened is that Israeli forces with their armored vehicles and jeeps, tanks, raided the village of Silat al-Harithiya in order to destroy the home of a Palestinian prisoner, this Palestinian prisoner, Mohammed Jaradat, whom the Israeli authorities accuse that he carried out a shooting attack against Israeli settlers. The Israeli troops were intending to destroy his home. Clashes erupted between the Palestinians living in the village of Silat al-Harithiya and other villages around this town with the Israeli forces. They retreated back. However, in the early hours of this morning, Israeli troops returned to the village of Silat al-Harithiya and succeeded, unfortunately, to destroy the home of Jaradat, this Palestinian prisoner. Elsewhere in Al-Quds, in the Palestinian neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah, the situation is still tense, with Palestinians are still protesting the settlers' attacks, settlers' aggression, and they clash together, the settlers and the residents of Sheikh Jarrah, and even the protesters who had been there. A number of Palestinians were wounded because at the end of the day, of course, Israeli forces attacked the Palestinians, protecting and giving the support to the Israeli settlers in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, Bahrain's top cleric has called on all Muslims to stand against any compromise with the Tel Aviv regime and its expansionism. Sheikh Isa Qasim says the Muslim community has the responsibility to oppose Israel's oppressive policies. He slammed the deployment of a senior Israeli officer to Bahrain as another sign of Israeli colonialist measure. On Saturday, Manamak confirmed the stationing of a ranking Israeli officer in Bahrain as part of an international coalition. The move was also criticized by main opposition group Al-Wafaq. It says that the ruling Al-Khalifa regime's decision for such an appointment was an attack on Bahraini sovereignty. Al-Wafaq also questioned the popular legitimacy of the Bahraini regime, saying the Al-Khalifa is on a quest to obtain a, quote, fictitious power from the Zionists. As Bahrain's popular uprising enters its 13th year, the country's top Shia cleric is calling on the nation to stand united in their fight against oppression. We've discussed that issue at length in our news review program.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in that country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there cannot be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. People demanded equality and freedom. The regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. Despite that, pro-democracy protests have continued. Joining me in this edition of News Review are Tim Anderson, he is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies from Sydney, and Zafar Bangish, he is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us in this edition of News Review. Let me first start with Zafar Bangish in Toronto. Today is the anniversary of the popular uprising in Bahrain that began in 2011, and despite its harsh repressive measures, the Manama regime has not been able to contain the uprising. I want to ask you this: what's the future outlook for the uprising in Bahrain?
Well, as you mentioned, March 14th marks the 11th anniversary of the people's uprising And the fact that the people have not given up, even after 11 years of extreme oppression, first through the Saudi military forces invading Bahrain to crush the uprising, the regime itself destroying the Pearl Roundabout or the Pearl Square in Manama, and yet the people's resolve to secure their rights have not been dampened. They continue to struggle for their rights. So in that sense, and obviously they are the majority of the people in Bahrain. And as Sheikh Isa Qasim pointed out, if the people remain united, there's a new constitution that guarantees the rights of all the people. Definitely, victory will ultimately be that of the Bahraini people through their uprising and just struggle.
Let me cross over in Sydney. The Bahraini regime has been trying to control the popular uprising with an iron fist, killing hundreds, jailing thousands, yet it hasn't been successful. And at the same time, the international community has been silent toward the aggression, toward the crimes that the regime has been committing. Why is this happening?
Because the so-called international community, by which typically they mean Western states and their passive populations, have been fed misinformation about the entire region. The most democratic of the Arab states were crushed in the name of a color revolution, and the actual revolutions of the region, the democracy uprising in Bahrain, the genuine revolution of 2014-15 in Yemen, are brutally crushed. And the propaganda follows those lines, basically. It's utter confusion when it comes to reporting in the Western world of Yemen and Bahrain. The only two, in the case of Yemen, the real revolution, and in Bahrain, the incipient revolution, which was crushed, as you've already said, by the Manama regime, backed by the Saudis, which the Western countries all arm and help carry out their dirty work.
Right. Mr. Bangesh, we know that Bahrain is a close ally to the U.S., and it actually hosts the U.S.'s Fifth Fleet. And the U.S. claims to be an advocate of human rights, but it hasn't done anything to stop the Al Khalifa regime from committing these crimes, and it hasn't done anything to make the regime change the way it treats dissidents. Why?
Well, basically, America's claim to being a democracy and champion of human rights is a complete fraud. I mean, you know, Guantanamo Bay, for instance, there are still at least 40 prisoners languishing, the vast majority of them completely innocent. You remember that back in 2002, when the torture chamber was opened in Guantanamo Bay, the Americans brought 700 prisoners over there, and they called them the worst of the worst. And we know the vast majority, I mean, that's almost 660 of them, have already been released because there were no charges, nothing against them. And also in the United States itself, we know that it oppresses its own black population. It has a horrible history of slaughtering the indigenous people. The U.S. in the last 20 years has committed horrific crimes here that killed millions of people all around the world, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, the list goes on. So I think the U.S. regime is in no position to claim that it stands for human rights or human dignity or democracy. And that also explains the reason why it is supporting the dictatorship in Bahrain, because the U.S. has the Fifth Fleet over there, and the U.S. knows that if a genuine popular revolution takes place in Bahrain, then obviously the people of Bahrain would not allow a U.S. military base to be continue to exist over there. So these are some of the reasons why the U.S. claims to being the human rights champion or defender are utterly false.
Thank you so much. Tim Anderson, let's take a look at the demands that protesters have here. They want a peaceful, democratic transition in their country, and they want a constitution that represents all groups of people. Why are they then being treated so brutally? What is it about their demands that sends fear down the spine of the Al Khalifa regime?
Well, the regime, of course, has no interest in democracy or human rights, as your guest said, nor does the U.S. The Bahrain, like Qatar, hosts a huge military base, a naval base in the case of Bahrain, and that's what it serves the purpose of the US there. Of course, what Sheikh Qasem said about a new constitution is a very important thing and should be focused on, because if there is to be a democracy brought to some of these petro-monarchies of the Persian Gulf, it has to be founded on some new writing of the law, new popular consensus about the foundation of those societies. So the idea of a new constitution, of course, is anathema to it's horrifies the Manama regime, and it horrifies Washington too. Washington has no interest in democracy or human rights in any of those states which serve its purposes in the region, which is a failing project to dominate the entire region.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on this edition of News Review. I've been talking to Tim Anderson. He is the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, who joined us from Sydney, and Zafar Bangesh. He is the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, who joined us from Toronto.
Saudi warplanes have performed air raids on the Yemeni capital Sana'a, targeting a communication system near the telecoms ministry. According to Yemeni sources, the strike destroyed the Tele-Yemen Telecoms Company building and damaged a neighboring building. Riyadh claims that the ministry is being used by Yemeni forces to control drones targeting Saudi positions. The coalition earlier asked civilians and the ministries in Sana'a to immediately evacuate. Last week, Yemeni forces said that they had hit a military target at the Saudi Abha International Airport with a drone. The Yemeni army, backed by popular forces, has intensified attacks in response to the ongoing Saudi-led war and blockade, which have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world, says Stephen Zeun's journalist in an article titled "Democrats Attack Amnesty Report on Israeli Regime to Justify U.S. Complicity in Human Rights Abuses." Stay tuned, please, for the second part of this article. What may have also provoked such a fiery reaction is the section of the report which appears to be referring to the United States. It reads, "Apartheid has no place in our world, and states which choose to make allowances for Israel will find themselves on the wrong side of history. Governments who continue to supply Israel with arms and shield it from accountability at the UN are supporting a system of apartheid, undermining the international legal order, and exacerbating the suffering of the Palestinian people," unquote. It is this recognition that the United States has a moral and legal responsibility to end its support for violations of international humanitarian law committed by strategic allies that has led so many leading Democrats to side with the Republican right in its attacks on Amnesty International. This intensified in subsequent decades when the organization reported human rights abuses by U.S.-backed Latin American dictatorships and paramilitaries, exposed the massacres by U.S.-backed Indonesian forces in East Timor, criticized torture by U.S. interrogators in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere, and documented the large civilian death toll in airstrikes by U.S.-armed Israeli regime forces in the Gaza Strip and U.S.-armed Saudi forces in Yemen. This time, as an indication of the rightward drift of the Democratic Party, the Biden administration and congressional Democratic leaders have agreed with the Republicans that research documenting violations of international humanitarian law by U.S. allies can no longer be tolerated. They have decided to take the political risks of attacking the world's leading human rights organization and lie about the contents of its reports to justify U.S. complicity in human rights abuses. Why would so many prominent Democrats risk alienating so many people in their base, including millions of liberals who have long supported Amnesty and other human rights groups, by making demonstrably false charges against this beloved and well-respected NGO? Perhaps they assume that relatively few people will actually read the report, and that enough of the public will believe their false claims about it to undermine Amnesty's reputation for fairness. Amnesty's reputation for critiquing human rights abuses across the board has been one of its greatest strengths. The organization has been critical of human rights abuses regardless of the violator's ideology, geopolitical alignment, ethnicity, religion, or anything else. The organization's reports have fueled movements to end U.S. culpability in war crimes, which threaten the profits of politically influential arms exporters. Perhaps the Biden administration and its supporters are making these false accusations that Amnesty International actually seeks to delegitimize or unfairly single out Israel in the hopes that it will damage Amnesty's reputation enough that reports about violations of international humanitarian law by other U.S. allies will not be taken seriously either. If the Biden administration and Democratic congressional leaders can get away with attacking Amnesty International for its criticisms of the Zionist regime's violations of international law, they could also start attacking Amnesty for its criticisms of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and other U.S. allies. Given the preeminence of Amnesty International in the global human rights movement, this is nothing less than a frontal attack on the human rights community as a whole. Making statements that are so demonstrably untrue is a desperate attempt by Democratic Party leadership to destroy the reputation of the thousands of activists, researchers, informants, and others who have in many cases risked their lives to document human rights violations around the world. Even when Democratic leaders initially rejected calls for sanctions on white, minority-ruled South Africa, they opposed military aid to the regime and were outspoken in their opposition to apartheid. By contrast, today, they support unconditional military aid to the Zionist regime, deny that the system imposed by that right-wing cabinet on the occupied West Bank is a form of apartheid and attack reputable human rights groups that present evidence otherwise. The Democrats figure that, with so many people scared of a Republican takeover of the House and Senate in November, human rights supporters will be reluctant to challenge their war on Amnesty and other groups. This may end up hurting the Democratic Party, however. With Biden administration officials, both the House and Senate majority leaders, heads of both the House and Senate Foreign Relations Committees, and scores of other congressional Democrats joining Fox News and the Republicans in attacking, misrepresenting, and outright lying in an effort to discredit and marginalize one of the world's foremost human rights organizations, people may start wondering whether they can support both human rights and Democratic Party.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi at-Tayyibin at-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we are taking our inspiration from the sermon number 168, which Imam Ali alayhi salam gave at the start of the Battle of Siffin. And this actually shows us what is important in Islamic leadership and Islamic governance. What a leader is supposed to encourage in the people. What Islam wants from the citizens what Islam wants from its citizens. What does Islam want people to have as a quality when they want to fight in a war? This is very important, because today when people go to war, they say the most important quality that a person should have is bravery, let us say, or needs to be strong, needs to have, needs to be agile, needs to have those war, be aware of the war tactics. But Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Usikum bi taqwa Allah," that I advise you to be pious, to observe piety. Look at the whole structure in which Imam Ali alayhi salam is thinking. It's beyond what normal people would think.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Usikum bi taqwa Allah," and then after that he says, "Fa'innaha khayru ma tawasal ibadu bihi," that I advise you to be pious. Why? Because piety and being wary of God, observing God in every aspect of your life, is the best thing that the servants of God can advise one another with. It is the most beautiful piece of advice that you can gift to your brother. You can sometimes advise many things. You can advise your brother or your sister in many good things, right? But those things are not necessarily the best of things. You can advise them about how to live their life, let's say what to buy, what to sell, how to build their houses, what car to have, what type of exercise to perform, and different types of advice you can give a person. But the best advice that you can give a person is to be pious. فَإِنَّهَا خَيْرُ مَا تَوَاصَلْ عِبَادُ بِهِ. Why is that? Why is taqwa the best? Why is advising someone to be pious the best advice for them? It is because it is that thing, it is that quality that is going to lead to the perfection of the human being. It is that thing that is causing the human being. It is that thing that is causing the human being to become lofty, to become closer to God, to achieve his purpose in life. It is that quality that is going to make this human being reach the apex of this historical growth that he has been having in the whole of time. So we see that this is something that is so important, and therefore I'm advising him with that. One who is chaste, okay, the one who is pure, living a pure life, living a life of goodness and piety and purity. This is something so beautiful and so good for a person that the beauty of this itself causes him to be far away from devilish inspirations and entering into darkness. And so that's why if you advise someone towards God, towards observing his duty in his life, that is the best thing you can do to that person.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
And then Imam Ali alayhi salam goes on to say, وَخَيْرُ عَوَاقِبِ الْأُمُورِ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ.
piety is the best conclusive state for a human being. It's the best ending for a human being. You see, it's the best situation to end your life with. Or rather, it is the best destination. So, as we said, piety and taqwa is not just the path. It's not just a way to achieve your destination. Rather, it is also the destination itself. That's how important piety is. Why are we doing all of these things? Why are you working hard? Why are you struggling? Why are you doing these things? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, I advise you to do this, this, that, and I advise you to work hard and to struggle. Why? لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ So that you become pious. So your final aim in life also is to become pious, to reach the state of piety. And as such, if a person works his whole life, struggles his whole life so that he can reach a state whereby in that state he is free from committing sins. He is so strong that he doesn't go towards the negative dimension of his existence and always remains in the positive state and doesn't, escape the limits that God has kept for him, then this person has not wasted his life, has not wasted its time. He has done the right thing. If a person reaches a state whereby he's always observing his duties, always observing God in every action and in every thought, in every feeling, in every emotion, in every state, then of course this person has achieved such a great position. So we pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He not only gives us the ability to be pious in our day-to-day affairs, but to also work to achieve the final aim of piety and to be pious in totality towards the end of our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He is closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials, so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by U.S. drone strikes. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kevin Gostzola, journalist. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Suppressed Whistleblowers Who Exposed Massacres in Syria. Stay tuned for more. Whistleblowers in the United States military exposed a strike in Syria that resulted in the massacre of around 70 women and children, according to an investigation by the New York Times. The command responsible for the strike, considered a war crime, may have taken place, but a report by the Office of Inspector General for the Defense Department removed this opinion. Officials in the Pentagon impeded an investigation and ensured no one would ever be held accountable for the civilian deaths. They also turned on one of the whistleblowers, forcing them out of their position in IG's office. What happened proves once again that going through proper channels can be a fruitless and risky career-ending effort. Lisa Ling, a former tech sergeant who worked on drone surveillance systems and is a known whistleblower, reacted, "Again, the public is notified of a war crime by a brave whistleblower who was eventually forced out of their job. This is a pattern that exemplifies the need for robust whistleblower protections, especially for the intelligence community so often carved out of them. We need more light shined in these secret spaces so this doesn't happen again and again and again without the public knowing what is done in our name." As the Times reported on March 18, 2019, in the last days of the battle against Daesh in Syria, when members of the once fierce caliphate were cornered in a dirt field next to a town called Maghuz, a U.S. military drone circled high overhead, hunting for military targets. But it saw only a large crowd of women and children huddled against a riverbank. U.S. military forces launched a double-tap strike. An American F-15E attack jet dropped a 500-pound bomb. As survivors scrambled for cover, another jet dropped a 2,000-pound bomb that killed most of the survivors. A high-definition drone recorded the scene prior to the bombing. Two or three men were near a compound. Though they had rifles, neither engaged coalition forces. Women and children were observed in the area. At nearly every step, the military made moves that concealed the catastrophic strike. The death toll was downplayed, reports were delayed, sanitized, and classified. And the Times added coalition forces bulldozed the blast site. The strike was the work of a classified U.S. Special Operations Unit known as Task Force 9. They were responsible for the third worst casualty event in Syria. According to the Times, an unnamed Air Force intelligence officer in the Combined Air Operations Center at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar contacted Lieutenant Colonel Dean Corsack, who was an Air Force lawyer. They were ordered to preserve video and another evidence from the F-15E squadron and drone crew. Corsack concluded a possible war crime was committed that required an independent investigation. He noted that Task Force 9 was clearly seeking to cover up incidents like this strike by logging false entries after the fact. For example, the man had a gun. The Air Force's Office of Special Investigations was notified. However, as the Times recalled, a major refused to investigate. Civilian casualties were only investigated if there was a potential for media attention, concern with outcry from local community and government, and or concerned sensitive images may get out. In other words, if the Pentagon needed to get ahead of a potential scandal, they would investigate and craft a narrative that could tamp down outrage. But they did not believe the Maghuz strike would ever make headlines. Corsack tried once more to convince his superiors to investigate in May 2019. They still refused. So Corsack filed a hotline complaint with the IG's office in August 2019. Jean Tate, a former Navy officer who had worked for years as a civilian analyst with the Defense Intelligence Agency and the National Counterterrorism Center before moving to the Inspector General's office, told the Times, "When Korsak came to us, he wanted to make it very clear he had tried everything else first. He felt the IG hotline was the only option remaining. Roadblocks prevented Tate from having any success. He could not find the footage from the task force drone that called in the strike. U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, removed the war crime finding from a report on the massacre." In January 2020, according to the Times investigation, the Deputy Inspector General refused to sign off on a memo that would have alerted authorities to the war crime. Tate did not hesitate to criticize leadership in IG's office, and by October 2020, he was forced out of the office. In May 2021, Tate contacted the Senate Armed Services Committee and sent a 10-page letter that detailed the Bowser strike. However, as of November 13th, he was still waiting for any member of the committee to call him back. To further illustrate how stunning it is that senators on the committee ignored what Tate shared, CIA officers in Syria were so alarmed by the conduct of Task Force 9 that they complained to IG's Office for Defense Department. According to one former task force officer quoted by the Times, CIA officers alleged that in 10 incidents, the secretive task force hit targets knowing civilians would be killed. The New York Times shared their reporting with CENTCOM prior to publication and asked for official comment. CENTCOM acknowledged 80 people were killed but insisted the strike was justified. The bombs killed 16 fighters and 4 civilians. As for the other 60 people killed, the statement said it was not clear that they were civilians, in part because women and children in Daesh sometimes took up arms, according to CENTCOM. This is actually part of the legacy of President Barack Obama's administration. He developed a method of counting civilian casualties that would not box him in. In 2012, the Times reported all military-age males in a strike zone found dead were presumed to be combatants unless there was explicit intelligence posthumously proving them innocent. If commanding officers refuse to support an investigation into a massacre, then they never have to worry about an investigation moving death in the combatant column to the civilian column, which would make them look bad. On November 3rd, the Air Force released the findings of the investigation into the U.S. drone strike in Kabul on August 29th that killed Zimari Ahmadi, an aid worker and father, his 3 sons, 2 of his nephews, and 3 girls who were toddlers. They exonerated themselves. The investigation found no violation of law, including the law of war. Air Force Inspector General Sami Said declared, "We did find execution errors combined with confirmation bias and communication breakdowns that regrettably led to civilian casualties." But Said is undoubtedly implicated in the cover-up of countless war crimes committed by Task Force 9 and various other special operations units which engage in similar bombing attacks. Meanwhile, drone whistleblower Daniel Hale is in a communications management unit, CMU, at a medium security federal prison in Marion, Illinois. He's closely monitored by the FBI and Bureau of Prisons officials so they can prevent him from further commenting on the bloodshed caused by the United States drone strikes. Commenting on how the cycle of violence with militant groups continues, Link stated, "They don't hate our way of life. They rightfully hate our way of killing. 70 innocent women and children were needlessly killed in Syria, 10 killed in Afghanistan, and plenty more we will never know about. These are human beings, and we took their lives while using sanitized words with fancy legal footwork to get away with breaking international law. It is wrong. It is terror. And I believe Americans are complicit as long as we remain silent about what is being done in our name. Link concluded, we cannot fight a war on terror with more terror.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day. Here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a beautiful tradition narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam regarding the free person, the free-spirited person, the free thinker. Right? Freedom is one of those virtues which everybody loves, right? But we rarely is it that somebody can provide a proper definition of for what freedom is. So these traditions are good in the sense that to kind of clarify what exactly freedom is, or a free-spirited person is, or a free person is in the eyes of Islam. The Imam alayhi salam says, the free is free in all his states. Meaning, he's not free in certain situations and he acts like a slave in other situations. No, he's free in all situations. When he is inflicted by calamity, he shows patience. This is one of his characteristics. He doesn't become enslaved in the situation and caught up in the situation and loses patience. No, he remains patient in this situation when he's afflicted by calamity. When afflictions bear down on him, they do not break him. They do not break him. And he doesn't lose control of himself when he's afflicted by calamity. Even though he be taken in captivity, this person, the calamity may be such that he may become enslaved by a person. He may be controlled by a person. He may fall under the power of a person. But this does not break him. He still retains his free-spiritedness. He retains his nobility and his honor in such a situation. Even though he may be taken in captivity or defeated, and his prosperity turns into poverty, he may be prosperous and become poor. But that doesn't mean that he becomes a slave of a person or submits to a person and loses his free-spiritedness. No, he remains free-spirited and he remains noble and it retains his nobility in such situations. The Prophet, the Imam alayhi salam, refers to one of the prophets, one of the divine prophets, the Prophet Yusuf alayhi salam. The Imam says, just like the truthful, trustworthy Prophet Yusuf, blessings of Allah be upon him, whose freedom was not affected even when he was enslaved, defeated, and captivated. But we all know the story of the Prophet Yusuf. He was sold into slavery, right? He became a slave of the Pharaoh. He became a slave of an Egyptian, and an Egyptian governor, but he still was free spirited. He became a prisoner in a jail, right? Because he was accused of an evil deed. But at the same time, when he was in the prison, he remained a free spirit. He remained a noble. He retained his nobility in such a situation, right? So the main thing that the Imam alayhi salam is alluding to is the true free-spirited person is the one who's not just free when he's prosperous and happy, right? He retains his characteristic of being free even in unbecoming and difficult situations. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the distinguishing trait of the free in the words of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.